Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
Where are all the gutless American wrestlers? Step in the ring with the Baron and face the brains.
The reason why Axe and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine is in government issue.
Hello, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for another episode. Hey, make sure you subscribe, right? I'm going to get this right off the top. Make sure you subscribe to us so that you do not miss any of our weekly episodes. Just hit it. Hit the auto-download. It'll always be there waiting for you every Wednesday morning. We have a really fun show for you today. My guest on this episode is Jumping Jim Brunzell. We talk about the High Flyers, the Killer Bees, and much more. But first, I do want to talk about just a few things before we get to the interview. The Claw, the documentary about Baron Von Raschke, is available now on Amazon Prime for purchase. And I highly advise that everyone goes and gets it and gives it a watch. I cannot recommend it enough. There's tons of great clips, interviews, photos, and the Baron's in it. And of course, he's just captivating as always. What, man, what a legend. So again, go check out The Claw, available on Amazon Prime. And then once you watch it, give me some feedback. Let me know what you thought of it. I absolutely loved it, but I'd love to hear your guys' opinions on it. Coming up on August 25th will be my next episode of my AWA Deep Dive series, and that episode will be looking at August of 1988. So if you have any questions about this month in AWA history, submit those to me on social media as soon as you can to have me respond on the show. I'll be recording very soon, so I need you to get those in really, really soon. On August 16th, the wrestling world lost Wild Samoan Offa. Offa had been battling some illness for a bit, and he was fighting hard. And it seems like we just reflected on the Wild Samoans not too long ago when we lost Sika. But they were a absolutely legendary, great team. They were very scary and intimidating. I always loved it when Offa came back to manage the Head Shrinkers in the WWE in the 90s. It was pretty cool to see that. And of course, anybody that follows me knows that I'm a huge fan of the wrestling movie Body Slam with Dirk Benedict. And the Wild Samoans have roles in that movie. So I always remember them a lot from that just because it was so cool seeing all the wrestling talent in that movie. But the Wild Samoans have a pretty important part in it. So I'm going to send good vibes and love to the office entire family. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll have my guest on, Jumping Jim Brunzell. So stick around.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories, whether it's Jamie Ward with Georgia 81, Roman Gomez with the UWF in 1986, or Gene Jackson covering Memphis in 85. Three projects going on right now over there at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to The Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. Bob goes back in time each and every week, covering not just his career, but countless stories and interactions with hundreds of wrestling names spanning his two decades in the business. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met, from Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our social media guides for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia Podcast Network? Plus, I'm constantly adding old school video clips and pictures from throughout wrestling history. You can follow us over on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at R-A-S-S-L-I-N Grenade. Also, follow and like me, Facebook.com/Wrestling Grenade. And why not subscribe to YouTube.com/Wrestling Grenade? So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
This is Listen to Their Screams, a horror podcast that feels like you're chatting with friends. Hello, I am one of your friends, Dave. I am one of the co-hosts of Listen to Their Screams with my friend Ike, and we want you to come and check us out. We are a fun-filled, positive horror movie podcast that does reviews, news, birthdays, anniversaries. We play games. We are a ton of fun every week for you, the horror fan out there. For all of our links to our social media and the podcast platforms, just check out our link tree. It is linktr.ee/listen2screams. That is listen, the number 2, and screams. Or look us up on your favorite social media platform and podcast provider. And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. At this time, I'm being joined by Jumping Jim Brunzel. Jim, how are you?
I'm very good, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I appreciate you giving me the time. Let's dive right into it. I want to say, before we get into the wrestling side, I want to, prior to training for wrestling, you were a standout college football player, and you had a tryout with the Washington Redskins. What was an NFL tryout like at that time?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about it. I was undrafted in college. I played a fair amount of time. We were running offense. I was a wide receiver, so I caught 11 passes for 99 yards in 2 years. No touchdown. I had a couple touchdowns in the spring games. But so I played 1 year as semi-pro in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, in the Central States Football League. And then from there, I got an invitation for this Washington Redskins in 72 tryout. And so I went down there, and it was 3 days long. And this was the year that they, you know, 1972 was the year they won the Super Bowl. So they had a pretty bad team, and they kept one guy from our group, and his name was Herb Mulkey. And he was a real fast punt returner, and he wound up being all pro that coming year in 1972. So I came back and I decided, well, I better go back to college, you know, and I contacted the Vikings, and I said, would it be possible to have a tryout with you? And Jerry Reichow was the head scout there. He says, Jim, he says, I'd love to have you try out, but he says, we hate to cut Minnesota kids. So that was it. So I went back to school, and then Greg called me and said, hey, my dad's, you know, training Ken Patera and Bob Bruggers and a Wisconsin private school heavyweight champion by the name of Richard Fleer. Mm-hmm. And then Khosrow Vaziri, who was, the Iranian. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had a nice camp, and it was 6 weeks long, 6 days a week and 6 hours a day. It was pretty hard. And finally, December 27th, 1972, I had my first match with, let me see. Oh, gosh. that just goes to show. But it was a draw. and from that point on, I thought, oh, God, here we go. So, you know, they sent me to Kansas City. And I was down there for almost a year, and we wrestled twice a night and 7 days a week. I worked for these guys had zippers in their and fish hooks in their pocket. That was Bob Geigel and Pat O'Connor.
Yeah.
So I was down there for a year, but it taught me a lot. I learned. I wrestled Bulldog Bob Brown constantly, and then you know the Funks came in and the Briscoes came in, so it was good. You know, you got to learn your trade, you know, one way or the other. So that was a great opportunity for me.
Yeah, I think everybody went through Kansas City had to wrestle Bulldog Bob Brown on a regular.
Oh, he was there. I think he's still there.
Yeah, probably. He probably is. Yeah. Oh, still a draw.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, you went out to Kansas City, did a few things, but then when you came back to the AWA, you started teaming with Greg Gagne, right? Did you know Greg all the way back to high school, or was it just in college?
Just in college. We were both walk-ons at the university. We're both 17 years old. He came from Mound, which is the south west suburb of Minneapolis, and I came from White Bear Lake, which is a northeast suburb of St. Paul. So, and he was a quarterback. I was a split end. So we did well together. We moved the ball and we became friends. And then he had me over to his house a couple times. And you should have seen his house right on the lake. And, you know, a couple $1 million home. And Vern had waterfalls in his basement. And, you know, and he had all this memorabilia about him. And he was a hell of a football player. He probably could have played pro football. But, you know, he's a national champion a couple times in college and then an alternate on the Olympic team. And then he, you know, went into pro wrestling and got exposed on that Chicago network.
Yeah, the DeMont. Yeah. You hear a lot of people knock Vern, right? Because of his late runs as champion when he was older. Yeah. People do not grasp how big a star Vern Gagne was like in the 50s on stuff on the DeMont network. This guy was a national star because of that network.
And I'll tell you this, Dave, is that because of his accomplishments, you know, in collegiate ranking and then also being the world champion, he got a lot of heat with all the promoters in the country, you know. I mean, and I'm going to say this, and I wrestled in the NWA, WWF. I was in the Mid-Atlantic and the AWA, and by far the best area was, you know, my home, the AWA, because you had time off and you made good money. And Hulk Hogan loved it here, but the fact that they wouldn't give him the strap, he thought, well, and, you know, and Vince was saying, hey, you come here, we're going to, you know, we're going to give you the strap and we're going to, you know, blow you up into the universe. And they did. He was the golden goose that created, you know, the WWE.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, you teamed with Greg, right? You formed the High Flyers.
Yes.
And you guys had a couple runs as tag champs. But even beyond that, you guys were a very trend-setting team, right? There's a lot of things, you know, the flashy, the teamwork, the, you know, quickness that you guys started doing before a lot of guys were doing it. How quickly, when you started teaming with him, did you guys kind of realize, hey, we got a little, something special here as a tag team?
I think the fact that we both got along so well together. And then the fact, Dave, that we had incredible talent here. Honest to God. I mean, the talent we had, you know, Bobby Heenan, Nick Bock, Winkle, Jack Lanza, Bobby Duncombe, Crusher, Bruiser, Mad Dog Vachon. You know, I mean, it was just incredible. And Les Wolf and, you know, Buddy Wolf. And every night, I mean, you know, you get to different territories and the guys you work with, you know, they don't want to look weak and they don't want to put you over and they don't want to sell and they want to make sure they come off, you know, looking good. And consequently, it's harder than hell. It's like, you know, going to the dentist and they haven't pulled two teeth with no Novocaine. So, you know, I mean, the fact that in the AWA, you know, we only wrestled 15 days a month during the prime season. You know, maybe 17 days. And then during the summer, you know, people were cooped up all fall and winter, you know, in the Midwest. So Vern gave us, you know, we work 10 to 12 times a month during the summer so we can enjoy ourselves. And we made a good living, you know. And I tell you, when I went to North Carolina, you know, George Scott, who he might have been a good guy, but he was the worst booker and worst finisher I've ever been involved with. And he, first thing he said to me, he said two things when I went to North Carolina. He says, don't loan Ric Flair any money. And he said also, don't ask for time off because we don't give it. So that was it. And then lo and behold, you know, I worked Ken Patera and I and Ray Stevens worked a couple different angles, and I was a Mid-Atlantic heavyweight champion. And then we did a deal with Khosrow, and Khosrow beat me with his loaded boot. So a couple weeks later on TV, I was working with him, and boom, I put the sleeper on him and took off his boot, and then ran to the interviewer. I think it was David Crockett, I think. Yeah. And I said, David, I said, I got his boot. I said, I'm going to beat the Iron Schnook. That's what I called him. And I said, I'm going to get my title back. So the first time I'm wrestling him, it's in Roanoke, Virginia, and it's an afternoon shot, and it's on Saturday. And that night we had a another match in Charlotte at 7:30. So I get to, I'm in Roanoke, and it's about 2 o'clock. Matches start at 3. So I come in, and we're main event. And I said to Sandy Scott, who was the agent there, and he was also, you know, George Scott's brother. I said, Jimmy, he says, did you get the finish? And I said, no. And I said, what is the finish? And he says, George wants you to do a Broadway. And I looked at him and I said, he wants me to do a Broadway. I said, Sandy, I said, if he wants a Broadway, I said, you might as well dig a hole right in the middle of the ring and bury me there, because I won't draw a dime. I said, I have Khosrow's loaded boot and I can't beat him in 60 freaking minutes. Come on. Yep. And that's the way George Scott was. He had Khosrow and I going around. You know, we went to these small Indian reservations, you know, where there was 400 people. Mm-hmm. And he'd want us to do an hour draw. And I still had the damn boot. And I says, holy Christ. Yeah. So, you know, I was so glad, you know, we had a little deal, and Khosrow, you know, told a fib to George. And so George fired me. And I says, thank you. I'm anxious to get home. You know, so I went through Atlanta and I wrestled there for about 6 weeks. And then I went back home. And it was funny because Jim Barnett was a promoter in Atlanta, and they had Ole Anderson, and they had, I don't know, they had about three or four different bookers, and it was hard to tell who was who. But Jim Barnett says to me, Jimsy, he says, what do you want in pro wrestling? And I said, well, I said, I'd love to be a world champion. I says, but I more than that, I'd like to go home, you know, to my, you know, to St. Paul, Minneapolis, and my wife and my two young kids. You know, I have suffered through 18 months of me being gone every day in Charlotte. And he says, oh, Jim, he says, if you go back to Daddy Ganya, he says, it'll be the worst mistake you've made in your career. And I said, well, Jim, I'm going to do it. So I went back there. I had the biggest year I ever had, made $85,000. And Greg and I worked with Jesse and Adrian. The East West Connection and drew record houses everywhere. So I wanted to, you know, when I saw Barnett when he was he was in New York, and I said, Jim, I said, I just want to tell you, I said, it was a pretty good move for me to go back to St. Paul. And he said, oh yes, I guess it was. And then he walked away.
Well, hey, when you and Greg finally split up, how come they never did a turn or a feud of any sort? And try to make a, you know, try to do a little business with you two.
Well, see, Greg would have been the heel, and Vern wouldn't have then gone what? For that, because he didn't want to have his son, you know, the son of the legendary babyface, you know, for 25 years, Vern Gagne, you know, Mr. Good Guy, you know, he didn't want to have a heel as a son, and I sure wasn't going to be a heel, you know, so I just, I thought, well, you know, I had, Terry Bollea, Hulk said, Jim, he said, if you want to go, you know, to New York, let me know. So the whole deal was Vince was sucking all the talent, you know, from all the territory, 26 territory. He had everybody. He had 60 guys. Yep. So, you know, I called him, and, you know, and then George Scott was a booker there. I thought, oh, Jesus. So I went there, and they put Brian and I together. And, you know, I mean, George, again, worked everybody's ass off. They had 60 guys, Dave, and we had three towns a night, and there was 20 guys in each town. And for 3.5 years after they put Brian and I together as the Killer Bees, we wrestled, averaged 27 days a month for 3.5 years straight. And we went 57 days in a row without a day off. And that's crazy, you know? And I mean, you're flying every single day. And then there was so much rampant drug abuse. It was just because guys, you know, you know, you wrestled and if you were hurt, you know, you had to mask it a little bit. So you took the pain pills, you took the bennies, you know, and that just metastasized into, you know, it was trouble working with these guys because, you know, guys thought, I don't want to do a job tonight. I want to beat you. You know, I mean, and they would, you know, they just didn't want to work the way they should have. You know, it wasn't one big happy family. You know, I mean, like I said, you had 60 guys competing, and Vince did nothing to accommodate us as far as our family lives or our professional lives. He just said, "Hey, you're working for me. Take it or leave it."
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And one name that also went to WWE that I wanted to ask about, and you mentioned him earlier, and was Bobby Heenan. And because I mean, obviously, because I'm a huge Heenan fan. I think Bobby Heenan is the best overall talent ever in wrestling. Just everything.
I agree with you, Dave. Yeah. You're absolutely right. This guy was a genius. He only went to eighth grade. That's the most he ever went to school. And he had great timing, and
the bumps.
Yeah, the bumps plus, you know, and he drank. Oh, poor guy. Yeah, I mean, he drank unbelievably. I remember, you know, and I remember one night he and I flew commercial and they had trouble with the small plane, so they were going to be late. So he and I had to do a 2 out of 3 fall, 45-minute time limit in Denver on the first match. And he said, "Jesus Christ." He says, "What the hell?" He says, "Let me throw you over the top ropes." And but we had a 45-minute, and both of us were tired as hell, you know, because we're going back and forth and we didn't know when they were coming in. And sure enough, somebody runs to the ring and they had a great, you know, Denver. All those AWA towns were incredible. But you're right, Bobby was by far the greatest all around talent. He knew what the people wanted, he gave it to them every night. I mean, his bumps and his, I remember, you know, and he was so good at talking. He was, you know, I remember the first time he saw my wife, and he didn't know her yet. And we were at a match, and she was walking by, and he says, "Oh," he says, "I see Jimmy been to the grade schools now to pick up his girlfriends." Because she really looked young, you know, but she, you know, and she was 19 when I met her, but you know, and that's the way Bobby was. And also, you know, he'd drink, and especially, you know, and all of the towns were big partying towns: Denver, Winnipeg, St. Louis, Chicago, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Minneapolis. But you know, all of us lived in Minneapolis. So I remember one time in Denver, it was a big house and they had a hell of a party, and Bobby got really, he could drink about a fifth of vodka a day. And so he comes back, we had to fly back on an early morning flight from Denver to St. Paul or Minneapolis. And then we'd get there at 11 and then we do interviews. And then at 3:30 we do a tape, you know, 1 hour show. And then we get back on a jet and go to Milwaukee or Chicago. So Bobby had about four people that he managed. So he's standing over Vern and Wally Carbo looking at the book in terms of who's going to be where on the matches and the interviews. So he leans over like that, and all of a sudden Vern goes, he looks up and he says, "Heenan, you've been drinking." And Bobby went just like this. He says, "You can't smell vodka." And he just kept on, you know. and Vern started laughing. He just, you know, but that's the way he was. He was incredible. And God love him when he got that throat cancer.
I know.
And you know something? There was 22 people at his funeral. That was it, because Vince didn't, you know, he didn't let the guys go. He, you know, he didn't give them the time off, and you know, everybody was afraid. And then I you know, there was two guys from the office there, and Vince wasn't even there. That prick, you know.
How much money did he make, Vince?
Oh God. Well, that's the way Vince was, you know. And
of course,
same thing with Gene Okerlund. Gene Okerlund died. There was nobody there. There was two people from the TV. That was it. And Vince wasn't there again. Oh, I was furious.
I bet. Yeah, well, I've heard you say before that, talking about Greg Gagne, that with him being Vern's kid, and I'm not trying to stir up anything there, but he said that you know, he was always paid a little more than you and would often pull rank. And that always frustrated you when you were at the AWA. Is that true,
it was to a degree, Dave. Here's the deal. Greg was part of the office. He was part of the booking session. So he got paid X amount of dollars more than I did. And rightly so, because they'd spend, 6 hours on a day booking these towns. And it was Bockwinkle, and it was Vern, it was Wally, it was Bobby Heenan, and Greg, and occasionally Billy Robinson for just a little bit of input. But, and the fact was that, I got booked in a lot of the shit towns, and he didn't. And, it just, so over a period of time, I love Greg. Matter of fact, I just came from his induction into the Waterloo Hall of Fame Friday.
Yep.
I drove down there, and it was they had Tito and they had Tony Garea and Arn Anderson and Greg and Al DeRuscia and, let's see, George Napoli. No, George was up there before. Gosh. But the whole thing, it was really well done. The only thing bad about it, Tony Garea talked for 35 minutes.
Yeah. Wow.
35 minutes. And after, half the people were going, they're bouncing around. And after he was done, I was going to raise my hand. And if he called on me, I want to say, Tony, I want to hear about your great, great grandkids. What are they doing now? But he didn't, I didn't do it. But it was a good time. And Greg, it was hard being the son of Vern Gagne. It was hard, man, because you were judged. And, Greg was a hell of a quarterback, a good basketball player and baseball player. Matter of fact, his son, JP, pitched for Creighton, which was a private Catholic school, and his catcher was Joe Mauer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then also JP went to Notre Dame and pitched in the College World Series, and he did get drafted by, I think it was Colorado team or whatever it was. So, he was a hell of an athlete too. And his daughter, Gail, was the highest scorer in Creighton girls basketball history. And I think just in the last year or so, somebody beat her out for how many points and what her average was, that was 30 years ago.
Yeah. Joe Mauer, pride of the Twins, Hall of Famer.
He just got inducted last week. And it was funny because I said to JP, I said, geez, I said, isn't it ironic that your dad's getting inducted and Joe Mauer's getting inducted too? And he says, well, he says, if my dad wasn't getting inducted, he says, they have three houses for all of the old teammates. For Joe Mauer rented in Baker, wherever it is, in New York. And he says, that's where I'd be. So, and it was good, it was good seeing Tito I knew Arn a little bit and he looked good and it was just fun. There's a lot of camaraderie. And then Brian Blair, the Killer Bee partner, he is president of the Cauliflower Alley Club.
Yep. Sure.
It meets, it's going to meet in, August, I think it's 19th, 20th, and 21st or something. So
yeah, in Vegas, wife, I think, right?
Yeah, in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And I've been out there a couple times. They gave Greg and I a tag team award there. And it was fun, and it was nice to see, so many people at a convention and all had one interest, and it was the love of pro wrestling. So it was nice, and hopefully it'll be the same when you go out there in August.
Yeah.
Can you hear my son's cat meowing in the
background? Is that what that was? Yeah, I heard it. I didn't know what that was. Yeah.
Well, that's my son's cat. And what happened, he just recently came back. He owns and runs his own film festival called Sound Unseen.
Oh, yeah.
He was down in Austin, Texas for 7 years. And then he moved to Mississippi for 2 years. And now he's back here. And he had a cat with him. And the cat, Jimmy lives in a one bedroom efficiency in an apartment in St. Paul. And the cat was used to stay in our house. And it's just my wife and I, and the cat had probably 20 places it could sleep and hide and everything. So at this place that Jimmy's at, the cat was meowing like a son of a gun every night. And so Jim couldn't sleep. And he says, Dad, he says, do you think you and Mom can watch, you know, Bruce? His name's Bruce. And he plays guitar and the cat. So I says, sure. So we've had Bruce with us ever since. And the little bugger, we call him Stretcherson too, because he stretches out like a real long son of a gun. And I spoiled him, Dave, because I put a leash on him and I walk him around our yard.
Well, I mean, that's essentially like a grandkid.
Yeah, well, you know, I got a 20-foot leash on him, and all of a sudden he'll just plop his ass down. And he's a big cat. He's 20 pounds. And Jimmy says, you're my cat and you're my fat cat. So he sensed that I was home this afternoon. And as soon as I get home, he said, meow, he wants to go out in the front yard and chew some more grass so we can puke it up in the
That's
carpet.
right. Yeah, that's right. Well, one thing that you're known for is your drop kick, right? You've always been credited as having one of the best drop kicks in wrestling. Do you remember when you first started hearing that about your drop kick? Because it became a thing, right? Everybody was talked about the Jim Brunzell drop kick. Do you remember when people first started saying that?
Well, here's the deal, Dave. I was a high jump. I was a state two-time high jump champion in Minnesota, and then I went to the University of Minnesota and lettered in track 3 years in a row as a high jumper. And you know, I didn't really have the body type, but the old adage that white man can't jump, I proved wrong, because I had 37 and a half inch vertical jump, and I jumped 6 foot 7 and a half, was my best high jump. And I did the dive straddle. I didn't do the Fosbury. So, and I think the best I did, I tied for fourth in the Big Ten indoor, I think my junior year. But so Vern knew that I was a high jumper, and I remember Vern says, "Well, you know," he says, you could probably use the drop kick as a finish." He says, "But," he says, "you," he says, "how high do you think you can drop kick?" And I says, "Well, hey, do you want me to go?" So he put his hand over his head like this, and I jumped up and I hit both of his both of my feet hit his hand. So it was about six, I don't know, 6'6" or something like that, 6'6", 6'8". And so I threw these drop kicks, and I'll never forget. This is another funny thing. So George Scott knew I threw a drop kick as a finish. So I come into Charlotte, and then the first time I'm working TV, you know what he says to me? He
Don't
says,
throw a
"Here's
drop kick.
no," he says, "I want you to throw five drop kicks." I said, "Five?" I says, "Why don't I?" I says, "Why don't I disembowel him and cut his nuts off too in the ring, you know?" Because I said, the whole idea is one, you know, one drop kick, boom, and then cover the guy. One, two, three, he kicks out, you know? And he said, "Well, five drop kicks." So I said, "Holy shit." So I did five drop kicks, and I can't remember who the guy I worked with. But the fifth one, I just about gave him a vasectomy, because I think I got him right in the groin. But I love, and I had some, oh, I remember I have some great pictures. Matter of fact, I don't know if you can see this, but I'm going to show you this. This was from Toronto, Canada, and it was in 1986, and Hulk was wrestling Orndorff, and this was in the front page of the Toronto Sun the next morning, and it had Greg and or it had Brian and I wrestling the Funk Funks, and it was Dory Funk and Jesse Barr. And I caught Dory with this drop kick, and holy Jesus, I hit him right smack in the head, and just right smack in the forehead, and he flew backwards, and it was a great picture. And so they got it, but you know, I felt real comfortable with that drop kick, and I must have thrown, I don't know, 5,000 of them in my career, maybe more. But then I had to have both my shoulders replaced and both my knees. And one hip, because when I come down from a pretty fair height, I'd use my forearms as a cushion, and I'd hit the mat, and then it would expand, you know, like a shock absorber. And so I ruined my shoulder joints on both sides. And pretty soon it got to the point where I couldn't put my shirt on. So the doctor said, "Oh," he said, "Jimmy," He says, "Your shoulder's bad." And I says, "Yeah, I know it." So he says, "Well," so they scraped one and that didn't help. So he says, "You know what?" He says, "We're going to have to put it, you know, two new shoulders in it." So, you know, I since I stopped wrestling, I've had 12 surgeries and they were a lot, but you know, you don't realize it, you know, when you wrestle every day and you're young.
Sure.
You know, I started when I was 22 and my last match, it was on my 50th birthday. And I wrestled, Ken Patera was running this independent show and I had to wrestle Jim Neidhart. And it was in Austin, Minnesota. And Kenny and Jim Neidhart were on a 3-day run of strippers and whatever that entailed. And Jimmy, I looked at him and his eyes were black and blue. And I thought, oh my God. And I'll never forget. He's no drop kick. No drop kick. And I says, "Jimmy, I got to throw the drop kick." I says, "Please just put your hand up over your mouth so I won't, you know, if I do hit you in the mouth, I won't hurt you." Okay. So time for the comeback and I'm going to go throw him in for the drop kick. And he sort of hangs onto the rope and I throw this drop kick. So he falls down on his back and my feet go way up in the air and they come down on his face and my heel hit him right here on his left cheek and opened him up. So he's got a cut about an inch and a half on his cheek and he jumps up furious. Nah! You know, and I said, "Oh shit." You know, so finally the match was over and he says, "Sorry." And I said, "Jim," I said, "if you would have just come off the ropes and not held back," I said, "not, this wouldn't have happened. You know, and it wasn't going to cost you $750 to get stitched up."
Yeah.
"Oh, God damn it." And thank God that was the last match I had last night. You know, God rest him soul. He died fairly young, but and I'll say this about Jim Neidhart. He was the hardest guy to work with in the ring.
Yeah.
And because he was like a little bull moose, you know, he was 5'9" and he was 275 pounds. And, you know, he was a power lifter, deadlifter, whatever the hell he was. And he also had a fuse about that long, you know, so, you know, and he was just impossible. He was a nice guy, but, you know, he just was so hard to work with. And I used to tell Brett and the Killer Bees and the Hart Foundation had a great matches.
Sure.
And 90% of them entailed Bret Hart being in the ring. Jeff was, you know, Jim was over in the corner and he was pulling on his goatee and I thought, holy Jesus, he's going to pull that goatee off right in front of everybody.
Yeah. Well, when you went to the WWE and you teamed with Brian Escobar, so how did that come up for you two to team? Was that just right from the get-go?
The fact was there was 60 people there. And they had everybody figured out as far as who's going to wrestle singles, this and that. And they had a lot of good tag teams. So they decided, matter of fact, it was Billy Red Lions in Toronto suggested that Brian and I get together. And because our last names start with B, that we take the name Killer Bees. And it just so happened that Lanny Poffo was there. And he just got a new package that he ordered from Carl and Hildegard. And he had two pair of black and yellow striped tights. And so he never got to wear them. We bought them from him and that was it.
Wait, so the Killer Bee tights were actually, those were Lanny Poffo's.
Yes.
That you bought from him.
Yes.
Wow.
And then, you know, we incorporated the mask and to be honest with you, it was the greatest babyface gimmick. Because nobody did that. And we wound up, you know, screwing the heels by doing exactly what they would do.
What they would do, sure.
Yeah. And we got over really well. And that knucklehead, George, or not George Scott, but, you know, Vince, you know, he just wouldn't give us the titles. You know,
what's the deal with that? Because Brian always has always said that you guys were promised the title, right?
Yeah.
It's weird. As over as you were in that run you had, it was just it just felt like it was going to happen.
Well,
what was the deal?
The deal was Vince didn't like me, and he didn't like Brian. He didn't like Brian because Brian was close to Hulk, and he didn't like me because various things that I questioned him on. And then also, you know, Brian and I wound up suing him, you know, because in our original contract, Dave, and I had two lawyers look at this contract, and I still have the contract. And it said, matter of fact, my one lawyer, Bob Stein, who was, he played football and was on the Super Bowl team with the Chiefs in 1969. He said, Jimmy, he says, don't sign this. He said, this is worse than an indentured slave contract. Yeah. That's what he told me.
Yeah.
So in this contract, it said outside revenue from, you know, like dolls or T-shirts outside of the WWE, we were supposed to get 25% of the gross. And this is when the action figures came out. And sure. I remember, you know, Cosgrove was in the first realm mm-hmm. of them and everything. And Cosgrove yep. got a check for $94,000.
Yep.
His
right.
first check. So we were in the second one, and yep. we found, he gave us a check for $10,000, you know, a piece. And I thought, 10,000 bucks. I mean, these things, you can't even find them. They sold so
sure.
quick.
Yep.
So what we sued him, and this was, Brian says, well, I don't think we should sue him. And he says, why? And he says, well, we won't get in the WWE Hall of Fame. I says, who cares? I said, wouldn't you rather have the money that you owe, that are owed?
Yeah.
Well, so we sued him. We got $100,000. And it turned out that he owed a number of the guys hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, but nobody else sued him. So that was another, you know, pin in my voodoo doll, you know, because we won and he didn't like that. So he just didn't like me. And I did, to be honest, I never liked him. I'll tell you a story. The very first time I flew in there, you do TV at Poughkeepsie, New York. So I flew in from Minneapolis and I flew into Newark and I get on the small prop. It's probably 16 people or something. And on the plane, I met this big, tall guy. His name was Jim Morris, Hillbilly Jim.
Yeah.
So that's the first time we became real good friends. And I just talked to him the other day. So we've been lifelong friends. So I get into Poughkeepsie, and Gene Okerlund had done many interviews with me as a, you know, as a high flyer in my own right as Jumpin' Jim. So he's going to do just a regular baby face interview with me. So he asked me just normal questions, and I answer in a baby face fashion, and I smile a little bit. And after we were done, as I was walking away, I heard Vince says, oh, God, we got another Backlund. And when I heard that, I thought, fuck you. Excuse me.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't say
no.
that.
No, no, but, it's perfectly fine.
But, you know, and that was my first day there. So right away, I knew that, you know, things were going to be hard with him. And you know, he quit. You know, I questioned on, you know, on the way he paid us. You know, I mean, one week we'd get $6,000 a week. And the next week we were in the same position in the card. And the card drew you know, $150,000 more that week, and we got $3,000, you know? So, I mean, you know, it was at his discretion, you know, he, you know, I'd say, Vince, I says, you know, we're working here and we're working there and the houses are up and we're on Hulk Hogan's card and da, da, da. And you know what he says to me? He says, well, he says, I'll have to ask my accountant. I'll get back to you. Never did, you know?
Yeah. Why ultimately did the B split up?
Well, here was the deal. They were unloading a lot of talent and they wanted us to do a job on TV for somebody. And it was a new tag team. And Brian just said flat out, I'm quitting, you know? And at that time, Dave, I owned a gym in White Bear Lake called Jumpin' Jim Brunzel's Gym. So I needed feeder money, you know, to keep her going. You know, I needed money from wrestling. So I thought, well, shit, what am I going to do? You know, I'm a pro wrestler. I'm 36 years old. You know, there's no other place to go to. I don't want to go to Japan again, you know? So I stayed and he left and Vince took advantage of me. And, you know, I had to do some jobs on TV with some various guys. And although I did work a match with Randy Savage on Raw one Monday night, it was a hell of a match. Honest to God, very first sequence, he grabbed a headlock on me and I shot him in and I took a tackle. I dropped down, I leapfrogged, and then I jumped up and hit him both feet in the mouth and he gets up spitting blood. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. And we had a hell of a match. And he wound up, he had the, it wasn't Ms. Elizabeth, but it was that other girl.
Sherry.
Sherry, scary Sherry.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She was his manager and somehow she distracted me. And the next thing I know, he unloaded off the top rope with that big elbow drop.
Mm-hmm.
And after the match, I knew it was a good match. And it was, I mean, it was boom, boom, boom. And he sold wonderfully for me, gave me a good comeback and everything. And then, so when I walked through the curtains, he and I, I shook his hand. And as we're walking back, Vince comes running out and he says, fellas, he says, that was the best TV match I've ever seen. Congratulations to both of them, to both of you.
Yeah.
And I thought, geez, you know, so. Then right away, my head's starting to, the brain's starting to tick. And I thought, well, that means I'm going to be going on TV, you know, getting beat by, you know, Heine Schwartz and Sammy Lapidus. So that was it. And then shortly thereafter, he fired me three times. And the last time, I think it was Pat Patterson who said, you know, Jimmy, you know, I think you better go. And I said, you're right. And I said, you know, I just burnt out, you know, they burned everybody out and it was just, you know, it was just drudgery, you know, I didn't like it anymore. And I, you know, I was tired of the travel and, you know, you had some guys, new guys came in and they thought, oh, well, you're going to have to do this for me. And you're going, I said, no, I'm not going to do that for you, pal. You know, if you get a fall over me, it's going to be a quick, you know, it's going to be a screw job where you violate something and then cover me. Hold my tongues, pull my, you know, pull my teeth out or pull my hair, you know, but I'm not just going to have you beat the shit out of me and then beat me, you know, so that's the way it ended. And I was so glad to get out of there. I really was, Dave. You know,
I always thought it was peculiar because I always thought they would have at some point, you know, I mean, and obviously, you know, you're talking about Vince, I can see the why. But I always thought, you know, they'd repackage you, right? Try to give you some, because they, you know, we're into their gimmicks and things. They would try to, you know, give you something to work with, so give you a gimmick, give you, at least give you a mid-card run and everything else. But
the deal was they never even took advantage of those masks. They could have made a fortune selling those masks to kids and they wouldn't do nothing. I remember the first, I don't know if you ever saw the first Killer Bee t-shirts. I have one.
Right.
I have. They looked like we were amoebas with wings on it in a, in, you know, under 6 inches of water. And I looked at Brian, I said, what in the world are these? He says, I don't know. We're lucky they made them. And I say, yeah, but I mean, how can you be excited about this? You know? And that's the way Vince was. I mean, he just, he didn't care. You know, he played games with people, you know, he'd screw people on stuff that he did for him to sell his, you know, gimmicks. And he did it, you know, knowing that he was screwing with the guy that he did it for, you know, like, because he was the guy in control.
Yeah. Yeah. And after WWE, right, you wrestled in the independents a little bit and did some things. You did turn up in Herb Abrams' UWF. You teamed with Brian again as Mass Confusion.
Yep.
But you always hear all these crazy stories. What was Herb Abrams like?
He was a train wreck that happened 2 or 3 days in a row. You know, God rest his soul. He had visions of grandeur, but, and in, you know, he shot for the moon, but he had substance abuse and he liked the hookers and, you know, and he was screwed up probably more than he wasn't, you know, and it was a nice guy, but you could see that he wasn't long for pro wrestling. I remember when he booked the MGM Grand and we're out there, I can't remember who we were working with, but I thought, holy Christ. And they had about, I don't know, I think they had about 8,000-9,000 people that showed up, you know, I mean, you know, it held probably 15 or 17, but you know, I was surprised and you know, I thought, well, you never know, but it just, it didn't, you know, he couldn't get the TV right. And, you know, he couldn't compete against Vince.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, you know, like you said earlier, right. You hung it up. You set it, you know, at 50 and, and got out of whatever. But you still, like you talked about, you still make plenty of appearances.
I
and
do.
Often with Brian, right?
Yeah.
You do a team thing. Do you like that? I mean, you seem to enjoy that side of wrestling and the conventions and meeting fans and reminiscing. Is that kind of something that's kind of enjoyable to you at this stage of your life?
Well, it is, because it gives me spending money.
Yeah.
I like it. You know, I mean, you know, they give you a couple grand, you know, 1500 to 2000, they fly in, they give you a nice hotel, you know, and, you know, you sign autographs for 4 hours, and some of these, you know, then the people are real, you know, they're real fans, and they know everything you did and know who you worked with and who, what angle you worked with. And, you know, I had pictures. I remember this. Matter of fact, just this deal in St. Louis, this one lady came up to me and she bought $140 worth of my gimmicks. She bought the comic book, my Matlands autobiography that's available on Blurb. Have you ever seen it?
I have, yeah.
Okay. And it's done well, you know, and everything. I wrote it myself, every word. And it took me 5 years to put together. So she bought that, and then she bought two pictures and had her pictures taken with Brian and I. And I looked at it. She says, how much is that? And I said, oh. And I think I gave her $20 off, and I think it was $140. And she says, that's okay. I said, thank you.
Yeah,
you know, so we made about, you know, we made about, about a grand a piece, you know, and just in cash. And, you know, just, you know, it was 2 hours.
Yeah. You can't beat that.
No, you can't.
And so let's wrap this up then. I don't want to keep you too long.
Okay.
And we you know, we've hit on all the highlights, but you know, like I said, you do a lot of appearances. Is there a best way for people to follow you so they can keep track of where you're appearing and what you're up to or anything like that? Do you have kind of a central location?
Well, here's the deal. I was going to have my son, he offered to do that for me and sort of be the booker, but I, you know, it got to the point where, you know, you get people calling and they'd say, you know, can you make this? And then I said, then they'd say, how much do you charge? And I said, well, at the minimum, it's $1,500. Well, I can't pay you that much. Can you do it for less? And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I mean, you know, some of these guys are getting $20,000, Dave.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
I mean, Bret Hart gets $20,000 to sign autographs. Ric Flair, even though he gets $25,000 or $50,000, he's still in debt. So, you know, I saw somebody sent me a deal that he's selling his robes now.
Yeah.
$75,000. And, you know, it just doesn't surprise me. God love him. He's been that way all his life. You know, he's the only wrestler I know that's made $15 million in his career and spent $20
million. Yeah. Well, let me ask before we get out of here, on Flair.
Okay.
I meant to ask you, right? We talked about, you trained with Flair, right? In the Vern camp. And then you saw Flair again in Mid-Atlantic when you were there.
Yeah. I did 3-hour draws with him.
Yeah. How much change was there in Ric Flair, the person, from that time? Had the Ric Flair we know started to develop yet? Because he was right on the cusp of, you know, becoming world champion, you know, just a couple years out from that. Well, had some of that ego and that stuff already started developing? But
oh, yes, without a doubt. He was so far ahead of us. And I mean, he could do an interview, you know, the second day of camp, you know, with Vern Gagne. He watched all the matches and he just projected himself. I mean, Ric Flair doesn't know who he is other than the pro wrestler.
Right. Yeah.
That's his persona. And that's the way he's been all his life.
Yep. Yeah, I don't think there's a separation between the two anymore.
No,
I think
not at all.
That's just him. So
that's him. You know, and then he calls me and he's in town and he had this Woo energy drink, and I know you're probably hurting for time. So I said to him, Rick, I want to get a six pack. He says, I'm going to send you a case tomorrow, or Amazon. I said, okay. So tomorrow comes, nothing comes. 2 days later, nothing comes. Then he comes to Minneapolis and he says, did you get the energy drink? I said, no. And he says, I'll leave you some at the hotel when I leave Monday. And I said, okay. So I called the hotel. I said, this is Jim Brunzell. Did Ric Flair leave me a case of Who energy? No, Rick wasn't even he wasn't even staying with us.
But yes, you're still waiting for the drinks, aren't you?
Yeah. I know there's a saying like that, but I told him, I emailed him and I says, Rick, I said, the check's in the mail.
Yeah. I always loved Ric Flair. Obviously, you know, admired his work. He's just one of those guys I wish, it's like, oh, Rick, I wish you could tone down and be that elder statesman a little bit. Because sometimes, I don't know, as a fan, I feel like sometimes he embarrasses himself, you know, and well, it's like.
You know, he's 76 years old. You can't keep doing that same old shtick.
It doesn't look the same.
Well, just like Hogan. You know, he's
that's another. Yeah,
and I didn't see that, but I refused to watch it. But when somebody told me he tore his shirt off, and I thought, oh God Almighty,
yeah.
You know, and to be honest with you, Dave, and I'm not getting into your political viewpoints, but he alienated 50% of his fan base by doing that.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, and
I know it. Yeah, but, I just Hogan's a whole nother. There's a whole other side of Hogan. Every interview he does, he's making up new stories, and it's funny to hear him talk about his career because most of what he says is not true. So
I know what you know, and he's been blessed. He made more money.
Absolutely, that's the thing. His stories are big enough as they are. It's like why do you need to tell lies? I mean, your career is big enough.
I have a Sports Illustrated. Magazine with him on the cover, and it says the Hulkster, the highest paid athlete in America.
Yeah,
and he was making $10 million a year. I have it someplace. I should try to. I'm going through all this vintage stuff that I have, and trying to. Everybody says, Brunzy, you're 70. You're going to be 76 in a couple of weeks. You better sign all your memorabilia because it's worth more money when you die with your name on it.
Wow.
I told my wife that because I guess it was Mike Graham and Eddie Graham that when they died, neither one of them signed all their shit. You know, their ring jackets and you know, people, I can't believe how much money they'll spend.
Yeah. Just tell them don't worry about it. You're leaving it all to your son's cat.
Yeah. Oh, Brucey.
Yeah. He's getting it all, so don't worry about it.
Hang on just a second. I'm going to get a shot of him here. Come here, Brucey. Come here. Come on, I want you to say hi to Dave.
Hey.
There he is.
Hey.
Brucey.
Yeah.
He's a tabby cat.
The heir to the empire there.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. Gene Jackson here inviting you to check out the Retro Wrestling Review, where each week I'm joined by some great co-hosts who help me review classic episodes of USWA Championship Wrestling. And right now we are doing week-by-week reviews of 1993. But we don't just do reviews. Sometimes we get a chance to interview some of the people who were there and lived it, plus do watch-alongs. It's a lot of fun, so check out new episodes that drop every Wednesday at WrestleCopia.com. And to find links to everything associated to the podcast, you can go to USWAPodcast.com.
All right, and thank you to Jim for coming on and doing that interview. I have to apologize earlier. My little dog was playing around with some of his toys and things over here and was barking. I don't know if you could hear it in the background, but I do apologize. In the intro, he was being a little bratty. So if you heard him, I apologize, and he just made his professional wrestling podcast debut. But anyway, follow me on X. I am there at the Dave Dynasty. It's probably the best way to follow me and keep up on what I'm doing. Make sure you go check out all the other WrestleCopia Network podcasts. The shows are all fun. I have great, great hosts. They're all just super entertaining, and they all touch and cover different aspects of the professional wrestling history. So go check those out. You can look them up by name if you know what you're looking for, or just look up WrestleCopia, or you can go to WrestleCopia.com, and that will guide you on your journey. Also, be sure to check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. They are located at ClassicWrestling.net, and you can also download their app on all your devices. They're on all smart TVs, phones, whatever. You can go look them up, Ultimate Classic Wrestling, and they are there. I highly recommend you subscribe to them. They got lots of great content for you to watch. Like I mentioned earlier, my next episode that we'll be releasing will be the next AWA Deep Dive episode covering August 1988. It will release on Sunday, August 25th. And then the episode after that, our next regularly scheduled episode, will be on August 28th. And my guest on that episode will be PN News. We talk about wrestling in Europe, of course, the WCW run, Salt and Peppa, and much, much more. It was a absolutely fun chat. Such a blast to talk to PN News. And you're gonna love it, guys. Don't prejudge. I know a lot of people roll their eyes at PN News and that whole period of WCW. But I hope when I have a guest that on your initial reaction makes you kind of do an eye roll. Give me a chance, right? I like to take pride in the fact that I guide my interviews a little differently. They're very conversational. And when I plan these things out, they're not haphazard, right? I don't get guests that I don't feel like I can have a good interaction and conversation with. And so give me a chance on all my interviews. But, you know, again, don't dismiss the PN News interview. It was super fun. One of my favorite interviews I've done recently. Paul New was such a great guy to talk to. I will be talking to him again in the future because it was such a joy to speak with him. And you're going to love it. You're going to be entertained. You're going to have a good time. And you just might learn a few things, at least from the perspective of PN News in his time in professional wrestling. So give it a chance. That, again, comes out August 28th. Now, I want to thank you all for listening, supporting, all the follows and interactions on social media. You guys are super great. Make it fun to do this every week. So until then, until the AWA deep dive in my PN News episode, which is coming up next week after this drops, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we've brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.